One day, reading the newspaper, a very sad story caught Dr. King's attention. In Memphis, some garbage men were caught in a tough lightning storm. Following protocol, they sought shelter in the rear loader of a garbage truck. The loader malfunctioned and crushed and killed two men. King continued to pay attention to the story as the weeks and months went by. In response to the tragedy, Memphis city officials rejected all requests for improving worker safety. This broadened into a wider conversation in Memphis regarding living wages and safety for all workers. The sanitation workers led the way. They went out on strike with American Baptist minister Reverend Lawson as the chair of their committee. Via phone, Reverend Lawson continually apprised King of the situation and encouraged his personal participation. The speech we just watched took place on King's second trip to Memphis in support of the workers who had walked off the job on strike. That night, they were preparing for a peaceful protest march, which was in violation of a court injunction. I just read a book which I cannot recommend too highly, Death of a King by Tavis Smiley. After years of in-depth interviews that Mr. Smiley made with friends, family, and close colleagues of King, Mr. Smiley shows an inside look at what became the last year of King's life. It's a focus on the last 365 days. Like the years before, in his last year, King carried searing pain in his heart from the murders of friends and countless martyrs, including Medgar Evers, Jimmie Lee Jackson, Emmett Till, four girls in a Birmingham church, and on and on and on. In the final year of his life, King carried emotional distress from experiences such as receiving an anonymous letter from J. Edgar Hoover's FBI urging King to kill himself before somebody else did. Many times, Martin or Coretta would answer the kitchen phone and hear a voice, a vicious, direct death threat, and they just place it back, hang up. Into the final months of his life, King carried the stress of knowing his biological brother and fellow minister, A.D. King, was highly distraught. A.D. and Martin had been jailed together more than once in the movement. A.D. drank too much alcohol, struggled with paralyzing depression and suicidal thoughts. Martin worried about his brother all the time. On and off for many of his last months, Dr. King himself was described by close colleagues as despondent, obsessed with death, and on the verge of a complete breakdown. Numerous friends suggested directly to Martin that he could benefit from seeing a doctor about his depression, and Martin knew they were right. He knew he could use the help, but he also knew that his phone conversations and activities were being closely monitored by the FBI. His phone was tapped. And any information about Dr. King seeing a psychiatrist would likely be leaked by Hoover to the press with the goal of discrediting the movement. Out of loyalty to the cause, King never sought help. One year to the date before his assassination, Dr. King gave a controversial speech of impassioned opposition to the Vietnam War at the Riverside Church in New York City. King outlined there the three-headed monster, which he would talk about tirelessly over his last year: militarism, poverty, and racism. This analysis put King on the margins with many organizations which had previously supported him. The New York Times and the Washington post had grown into supporting King in the movement over the years, this turned them into very harsh attacks on what he was doing in editorials. Most painfully for King, people within his own leadership circle, including Jesse Jackson, James Bevel, Baynard Rustin, and others, verbally just disagreed with him for hours, vehemently exhausting him. King's new expanded analysis brought attacks from top circles of African American leaders, including Thurgood Marshall, to be Supreme Court Justice, publicly speaking out, and Adam Clayton Powell, the most senior black U.S. congressperson. People King had previously counted on to be in his camp now said with regularity, "Doc, you've overstepped your bounds. Where's your common sense? Where's your concern for our people? Your ego has gone out of whack." And those attacks hurt him to the core. Many times over the year, people talked about coming in and seeing him weeping, just crying uncontrollably. Setting this context, it's all the more remarkable that time after time, when discussing the dangers of his own life, Dr. King declared, "I would rather be dead than afraid. I will not go that way. I just want to do God's will." Tavis Smiley writes that no matter the cost, King lived and died for the values of justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates. With those principles, Doc consistently declared that he would never give in to what he called the luxury of despair. The man had a million things to despair about, but he said, that's a luxury I cannot spend my time on right now. No time for that, we can't afford it. He'd been to the mountaintop and seen the promised land. And for King, that was a place that had people engaging in concrete acts of love. People acted with creative altruism in the promised land. And for him, glimpses of the promised land had included Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus the board, which combined to integrate public schools, saying separate and unequal is over. Countless people had sacrificed, no matter the cost, in order to get everyone the right to vote. They had paid the price for the Civil Rights Act, ending discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. That included the rights of housing, employment, and public accommodations. Those were glimpses of the promised land that he had seen. And for Doc, as his friends called him, glimpses of the promised land also importantly included small acts such as being with mothers who were crying because they were so poor they didn't know how they could feed their children and consoling them. More than once, he gathered a group of prostitutes who were talking out against him in the movement and said, "Tell me what this is about. Let's sit down. I want to learn about your lives." And that's just the being together and talking and sharing was a glimpse of the promised land. Everywhere he went in these conversations, whether he was talking to 10,000 people or one, he said, "The core of the movement is that I want you to be able to rise up and say, you are somebody. You are a child of God." That's the core. Today, in 2015, it's truly remarkable to see how many of the same problems of militarism, racism, and poverty continue to haunt our nation. If he were here today, he could preach many of the same sermons he did in his last year. They'd be completely pertinent. Today, under President Barack Obama, our nation spends more on military than any nation in the history of the world. And yet our president is derided as weak on defense. There's precious little leverage in any conversation to reduce spending on the military. Today, in one of the richest countries in the world, poverty threatens the very fabric of our society. 14% of our children, over 10 million children in America, are in poverty. They do not have a daily guarantee of enough food. Lack of sufficient support from many of our public schools rips us to shreds. Today, we're the nation with the most people in prison in the world. And people of color go to jail at disproportionately high rates in comparison to the crimes they commit. Dr. King could preach the same sermon today he did for the garbage men of Memphis in 68, the night before his assassination. The message would be right on time. It's almost 50 years. And Dr. King is not here. And we are here. We are here, and we have the example of the people of King's movement as shining stars in our universe that should remind us that just about when we think we can't do any more to effect justice for all, service for others, and a love that liberates, we probably can do a little more. We probably can pay a little bit more of a price than our brains trick us to think we can pay in order to get to the promised land as a people. Monday passed. Over 600 people came to our church to engage in service, education, and advocacy. Tens of thousands of people did so around the city. In the afternoon, many of us marched downtown, calling America and Philadelphia to more fully live out her creed. This coming week, there's a Raise the Wage march in Harrisburg, and Dennis Brunn is going with different people from UU Plan. Dennis, stand up. If you want to hook up with Dennis to march in the King tradition, go and do it. We're building the promised land. You don't just get picked up by a helicopter and dropped into the promised land. We have to take up some of the brick structures where there's too much investment in the military and prisons, and we got to repave some areas of education and job training and health care. It's not just one day, not just last Monday. It's weeks and months and years of making sacrifice. Know that if Dr. King were here today, he would reaffirm what you already know. You can make a difference. Being with somebody who's feeling low, talking with somebody and helping them believe in themselves, reminding him or her that she can rise up and say with belief, I am somebody. You have the power to help somebody do that. Don't forget. We, as a nation, have some difficult days ahead, no doubt about it. But hear these words of Dr. King. If we do this, we will be able to turn this nation upside down and right side up and cry out that we are all children of God. At that moment, the morning stars will sing together, and souls of God will shout for joy. This will be a glorious day. I invite you to say that with me. This will be a glorious day. Blessings be. Amen.